You're listening to Episode 9, Season 11 of the GNU World Order. This is GNU World Order, Episode 9, Season 11. And in this episode, I'm going to be taking listener feedback and kind of being subject to that listener feedback, primarily talking about comparison tools, diff tools, of all things. And it's actually really interesting. There's more to a diff tool than you might think. And then after the coffee break, I'll talk about paying for stuff, which I've talked about before, but this is a different take. So let's get started. In the previous episode, episode 8, I had talked about some utilities that I was using, and one of those utilities was a diff tool called Compare, K-O-M-P-A-R-E. And I got some feedback about that. I got quite a bit of feedback this past episode. Two of them were about Compare, and one was from Doru, who you might remember hearing from before if you've listened to the show often. But Doru says that he quite enjoyed the subversion comments specifically. And he said, coincidence has it, this is him now, coincidence has it that last week I had to migrate the SVN server that we use at work to another machine due to unstable network access at its current location. Obviously, I slipped in the idea to phase out the previous Visual SVN server on Windows setup in favor of a Debian and Apache dav/usvn solution that took me a couple of days to get running, but I'm happy with what came out. The place I work at is a Windows shop. SVN is the VCS, that's version control system, of choice because of historic reasons, coupled with the fact that it's perceived as a quicker to learn workflow with less glossary to learn when compared to Git. Regarding your Dolphin/Compare setup, there is a software suite for Windows called Tortoise SVN, which does exactly what you were describing, but everything is tightly integrated that hooks into the file browser and allows you to manage the whole workflow. So that is interesting to hear. This is Klaatu again. That is interesting to hear that there is a visual sort of hook into the file manager on Windows that you can get to do the SVN workflow all graphically. It would be interesting to see more of that, I think. And maybe there is more of it, I don't know. But for both Windows and Mac, you know, just so people could potentially do the Git workflow within the framework that they're sort of used to. I mean, on Dolphin, I emphasize again that it is really, really easy. Like, you can do a complete basic Git scenario just all in Dolphin. I tried it just for kicks the other day, and yeah, I clicked on a file, I edited it, I saved it, and then in Dolphin, I right-clicked and did a git add, and then I did a git commit and wrote the commit message right there in Dolphin. It popped up a little text box for me to do that, and then I did a git push, and it all worked. It took seamlessly from Dolphin. Never, quote-unquote, had to use the terminal for the whole sequence of events, which is quite nice to have that option anyway. Doru continues to say, funny enough, even though we are using SVN to version control Windows software projects, merge conflicts happen pretty rarely and are usually easily solved. But this might also be helped by the fact that the code is spread over many files, and we usually coordinate what each person works on in different parts of the project and avoid stepping on each other's toes. So it's great feedback from someone, you know, out there in the real world using this. I mean, not that I'm not in the real world, but I'm just so new to SVN that I don't really know what's common, what's to be expected. Add to that I'm actually not using SVN anymore. Just as of pretty much between now and the previous show, the migration to Git was complete, and I will not be having to use SVN anymore. So that was a weird, offbeat 6 month chapter of my life. Just SVN all of a sudden in 2017 for 6 months, and then not again. And hopefully never again. Not that I hated it without any, you know, with beyond reason or anything. It's just I didn't enjoy it, and I didn't feel like it was getting me anywhere to really know a whole lot about SVN. But at the same time, it never really hurts to learn. So especially if it's open source technology, I don't really mind. And there is a project out there that I contribute to a little tiny bit that that does use SVN. So, you know, just being able to use it and be somewhat comfortable with the concepts wasn't really horrible. And if it took 6 months out of the year to learn that, and I was able to learn it in conjunction with still using Git in my real life, I think that's okay. Another comment I got was from Josh, and he said that he had just listened to my show, and regarding the section on compare, can I point you to kdiff3? And he gives me a link, kdiff3.sourceforge.net. He says, use it as Git merge tool when Git complains about conflicts. Git config dash dash global merge.tool kdiff3 is the command for that. So git config and then dash dash global to make it apply to all your projects, if you want it to be global. And then merge.tool is the property that you're changing, and then kdiff3 is the attribute. Or the value, I guess. The merge.tool would be the attribute. So yeah, that's an interesting suggestion. To clarify, of course, I actually don't have problems with the git merge workflow that I personally have. If there's a conflict, I just open it up in Emacs and take the changes that I like and discard the ones that I don't, and then save it, and that works quite well for me. However, I did get yet another email, this one from Tim, and Tim says that he uses something called Beyond Compare at work. And he uses it just because he has to. That's what they use at work. So I didn't get the sense that he was necessarily recommending it as such, but he kind of mentioned it, and he said that it seemed pretty good to him, and mentioned that I ought to try it for kicks and kind of compare it to compare. See what he did there with the words. So that's three different comparative diffing tools on the table now. So I think what we are up against, I think there's no way to ignore this. I think we're going to have a diff showdown. So let's do just that. Let's look at Beyond Compare. Let's look at kdiff3. We've already looked at compare. So we'll take those three and kind of look at their capabilities, talk about what they can do. Maybe it'll be informative. Who knows? I mean, when you get right down to it, a compare tool is a compare tool, right? I mean, it's diffing two things. And it's a little bit almost surprising that there could be so many different variations of such an ostensibly simple tool. Especially when you just do a diff in the terminal, you basically get the same information. So it's kind of interesting that this has become a topic, really, of discussion, because you just wouldn't think there would be that many different takes on the same process. But there clearly are, and obviously comparing compare, kdiff3, and beyond compare doesn't even begin to approach all the different ways that you could compare text files. But that's what we'll look at, because that's what I got emails on. So let's do that. Let's do that now. First up in our diff showdown is, let's go with bcompare. Because, here's why, because bcompare is a little bit of an oddity. It's a little bit of a black sheep, as they say. And the reason I say that is because it's actually not open source software. And yet, it releases for Windows, Mac, and Linux. So I can actually try it without running it in Wine or something wonky like that. So that right there, to me, is kind of interesting because, yeah, it's not, obviously not unheard of for non-open source software to be released for Linux, but it is still one of those things, I think, in this day and age. It's still a little bit of a, you know, you look at it and it's worthy of note. You do notice it. So I went to the, I did a search for Beyond Compare, and the executable, when I install it on my system, is just bcompare, the letter B and then the word compare. But the software itself is called Beyond Compare, and it's by a company called Scooter Software. So if you go to scootersoftware.com, that's S-C-O-O-T-E-R, software.com, you'll find that this company apparently makes, you guessed it, a diff tool called Beyond Compare. I mean, that appears to be their product. That appears to be what they do. That is their sole product. Now, maybe they have a different site somewhere for other products, but certainly their main site, scootersoftware.com, gives the impression that what they do is a diff tool called Beyond Compare. If you go to the downloads, you'll find your downloads for Linux, and there's 64, 32-bit, and there's a Deb version and an RPM version. I downloaded the RPM version and installed it on my Fedora 25 laptop at work, and I installed it on my home Slackware computer. So the Slackware install was very simple. It was RPM to TGZ to convert the RPM to a Slackware package, and then install PKG beyond or bcompare asterisk TGZ, and that installs it. Much to my delight, it ran without any further modification. That doesn't always happen. It usually happens, but sometimes there are weird little dependencies that the RPM spec file has that you don't know about, so you have to install something else, but for this it is completely I guess self-contained. The install itself really doesn't install that many files. Like, the bulk of it is the documentation. I mean, in terms of sheer line numbers in your install log, the install itself provides a couple of libraries, .so libraries, a couple of, some of which are for integration into your file manager. So there's one for Kaya and for Thunar and Nautilus and KDE and Conqueror. And then there are some, obviously, an executable file. The executable file for the package is not called Beyond Compare, it's just bcompare. And there are a couple of different levels to that. So there's bcompare all lowercase, which gets into your USR bin folder. So that's what you actually launch. And that turns out to be a shell script pointing to /usr/lib64/bcompare or beyond compare, a directory containing the actual bcompare executable. That's capital B, capital C, O-M-P-A-R-E. And that's some kind of executable that uses Qt for its GUI, and it launches, and it's pretty much, you know, what you would expect, kind of a Linux-y looking application. And in terms of what I guess it looks like on the surface, I would say, like, at first glance when I saw it immediately, I thought, oh, this is like Eclipse. And I, again, that's totally surface kind of, like, looking at it, to me it's superficially resembled Eclipse. Now later I was kind of crawling around on the Scooter Software site, and I saw that they do some plugins for Eclipse. Not I don't know what kind of plugins, I didn't look at it that long, but they do seem to be hooked up into the Eclipse ecosystem at least a little bit. So maybe that was an influence upon their design, I don't know. Or certainly their icon choice. To me, that was just, it really looked like Eclipse. But I mean, that this is from someone who's used Eclipse for like 10 minutes. So it's got a couple of different modes that you can use, and it's pretty obvious as to what those are, because the landing screen when you first launch Beyond Compare contains the five different modes. It's right there. They're big icons in the center of the window. It provides a folder compare, a folder merge, folder sync, text compare, and text merge. And I guess I should say not all five. That's five of the major ones. There are also modes for MP3 comparing, hex comparing, table comparing, and picture comparing. So we'll get into that in a little while. The folder compare is, if you click on that one, it opens up a session window that I would say is pretty much what you would expect. It's you know, it's a toolbar with a big empty workspace in the middle of the screen. And then on either side of the toolbar are fields for path entry. So you could enter a path to one folder, which I will do. And if you do that, I will say somewhat disappointingly, it does not autofill as you type. So that's a little bit, at least in my experience, what I come to expect, for instance, from KDE, that does not meet my expectation. I'm used to starting my typing and then it autofill, you know, it detects where I'm going, right? So if I slash run and then slash media, surely it would then scan my media folder and see that there was a CLAT2 folder, and in that CLAT2 folder there's going to be a hard drive, and in that hard drive there's my backup folder, you know, that kind of thing. And it doesn't do that. It does not autocomplete as I type. So that was kind of surprising to me. Another surprising thing, well, so if you don't, you know, if you don't have the path memorized and it's not autocompleting for you, so you can click the browse button, obviously, to go choose the folder graphically that you want. So I did that, and again, to my surprise, it didn't use my system sort of like the default KDE file chooser, which I would have expected it to do because of those libraries that I got, that I saw fly by in my install log, where it was sort of tying into like Nautilus and stuff like that. But maybe I don't understand the scope of, for instance, Dolphin and Conqueror and Nautilus. I always kind of assumed that the file chooser dialog was a subset of those things, but I guess maybe it's not. So it uses its own file chooser, its own GUI file chooser, and that's fine. That's pretty common on Linux, all too common on Linux, and to be fair, it's common enough on other systems as well. In the end, you get there, right? You get your two files, to your two folders, your two directories to compare. You have them lined up on the left and the right of your screen, and you see the differences between the two directories. The way that you see it are that it is that the any folder that is common to both is colored sort of, at least by default, light blue, the directory icon. A folder that is missing on one side but is present on the other, the one where it is present is colored purple. And then when there is a difference between two directories, then the one that has more files in it than the other is colored purple. And I don't think I tested what happens if the two directories are just completely different. I didn't really check that. But there you go. It's a pretty nice little visual display of, okay, what's different about these two folders. Now, I'm not going to go through every single mode, don't worry, because there are a lot of modes, but I do want to get to the obvious one, which is the text mode. So if you go to session again and say new session and go to text compare or even text merge, pretty much you get the sort of standard side-by-side setup with the path fields at the top and then a big empty blank space in the middle, and you can choose your text files the same way. You browse for the file, and then you've got, once you've got them loaded, you've got a comparison side by side of the files. You get to see the text where it lines up, and you get the text where there's a difference. The way that compare, KOMPARE, handled regions of text that existed in one but not the other was this kind of weird, bigger on the outside, smaller on the inside type of thing, where as you scrolled, it was really cool. You could see it, and like you'd see the text kind of expand, as you know, that existed, and the text that didn't exist would kind of freeze in place, and that was kind of how you dealt with the difference in in length of two different files or two different regions. And in this, it's a lot simpler. It's on the left, you have the text that exists, and then on the right, or, you know, however you've got it. But on one side, you have the text that exists. On the other one, you just have this sort of a hatch pattern, this cross-hatch pattern, saying, you know, kind of representing a region that simply does not exist in this particular file. So it's visually, I would say, it is quite obvious as to which is which. I wouldn't say that either one is better than the other, frankly. They both do their job really well of highlighting when something exists and when something does not exist. I would say that it's quite obvious. Now, you also have a kind of merge action that you can do. So if you like something on one file that you want to port over to the other file, there's a little arrow on the left that you can click, and that will make those two regions the same. And now you haven't saved it yet, but you have merged two regions together. And you can do that in either direction, and it makes it very clear as to which direction you are merging in. One arrow points to the right, one arrow points to the left. You can kind of get the message. So that's pretty well done. I have no complaints about that. It's pretty easy to spot the parts that are different, so it's not difficult to kind of, you know, you don't get lost, you don't get confused. It's pretty clear, I would say. You can swap sides. That's kind of nice. Like, if you have it loaded up and you're finding yourself, especially for, like, differences in SVN, at least for me when I was doing it back in the old days when I was using SVN, and by that I mean, you know, last month, I would open the file, you know, sort of the source file on one side and the destination file on the other, and then I would keep forgetting which was which. And so you kind of eventually sort of, especially when you're merging files, it's kind of weird because there is no source and destination, and then other times there's totally a source and a destination. So yeah, it gets confusing, but you can swap sides. So if you're finding yourself getting confused and you're thinking, oh, I feel like I'm working left to right here, but really, or right to left here, and really I want to be working left to right, you can swap, and then the files appear on the opposite side of the screen. So that's nice. There are buttons to go, you know, to the previous change, to the next change, that sort of thing. It's, yeah, I mean, again, it's basically what you'd expect. It's a diff tool. Not really that big of a deal in a sense. It is very much exactly what you would expect in terms of the options and kind of the workflow. I would say that it is exactly when if you handed this to someone and said, here's a diff tool, they would not be surprised. This is absolutely the diff tool. And once you've made your changes, you can save the changes to files, so then you have merged the two files together. And obviously you don't necessarily have to do that. You could just compare. But I think typically if you're comparing, you're probably also merging. Now, there is a separate thing called merge, and in that event, you can go to a merge session, and here you've got the option to merge into a third file, so a non-existent file. So you can open up two separate files, which I'll do here, oops, and then kind of decide very graphically which. And they call them ancestor files, and that's so that you can kind of get which, you know, what files make up this new sort of descendant file. When I first saw it, I thought, well, this is kind of interesting. This is kind of new and different. And then I kind of thought, I don't really see when I would ever use this at all. It just seemed like a very roundabout way to take apart a file and put it back, you know, to take two files apart and then put them back together as one. That said, maybe it's something that you, maybe this would be a useful workflow for you. Once you've combined them, you can always kind of swap out the ancestor that you use, if you want to think about it that way. So you could say, well, I want this particular ancestor, and then if you change your mind, you can insert a different one. So it's almost like your third file kind of has this weird kind of fluidity that I guess superficially you don't feel like you have if you're just copying and pasting, which is kind of weird, but yeah. So basically it's almost like you're making a file consisting of include statements, and then you've got a graphical representation of what each include points back to. I found it very confusing, however. I found myself really struggling to keep track of which section was from which ancestor, because the color coding just seemed to change every time I would click something. So I would click, you know, from file A, insert this segment, and then from file B, include that segment. Oh no, I don't want file B there. Switch back to file A. And by the end of it, I just had so many, I couldn't tell you which, what was from what. So it was very, very confusing for me. I found this not helpful at all. I could see, however, how people might find it helpful. I could see how you could get used to that workflow and kind of take it and run. So there are other modes, lots of other modes, text merge, I just talked about that, table compare, hex compare, MP3 compare, and picture compare. I didn't really try any of those other than picture compare, because I was curious as to what that did. And what that does is it brings in an image, and then you bring in two images, and then it just overlays those two images, one with like a 50% overlay, and where things intersect, it becomes highlighted so that you can see very clear, or maybe it's rather when they part, they become highlighted so that you can tell, you know, if you're just looking at two very similar images and you just want to see a quick, like, what is different about these two barely different images, and then you see sort of this pink highlighted area in the background, and you think, oh, this one someone photobombed, and that one no one did, so perfect, let's take this one, or rather that one. So it certainly did its job. I would have never, ever, ever in my whole life thought to turn to a diff tool for that kind of functionality. I absolutely thought, like, the moment I saw it, my first thought was, why wouldn't I just do this in GIMP? Like, I would just bring in two images in GIMP, I would bring them into the same canvas, and then turn one slightly transparent, and look at the differences. And that's how I would do that. I've been doing it that way for my entire life. Like, that's a very common thing. If you've got, you know, if you've been on a photo shoot, or if you've got two video clips and you're trying to line them up or something, yeah, you make the top layer slightly transparent and see where they differ. And so that was, to me, having that in a diff tool just seemed really odd. Again, that said, it's a great tool to have, I would imagine. I mean, think about it. Like, you don't want everyone in your office to have a ridiculous license for some ridiculous graphic software, in which case you should just be using open source software anyway. But maybe you don't want people to have to learn how to use GIMP, because, you know, bringing in two images and making one transparent is just so difficult. Anyway, what I'm trying to say is, maybe for some reason you want people to have quick access to an image comparison. Maybe they're living in this diff tool anyway, so having that there is just a useful thing to have. Either way, it's got it. It's a feature. And that's that. So let's move on. So there is KDiff 3, which is the suggestion from Josh, and he says that he uses it, or he says that one can use it, let's put it that way, to do a merge for Git. And indeed, this tool, I would almost say that in a way it's a little bit like it was a little bit like a combination of bcompare and compare, because certainly the look of it, I would say, is less flashy than compare. I think of all three, compare is the most visually stunning of all three. I would say compare is the one. Like, it's got this cool effect, lots of colors, lots of regions that light up and sort of bring your attention to what state of merging or not merging they are in. So I would argue that, yeah, they in many ways compare is the flashy one. Bcompare and KDiff 3, I would say, are a little bit more conservative, and that's okay. I would even say that KDiff 3 is probably the most conservative of all. It's very kind of raw feeling, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, and in fact it might be a really good thing depending on what you're used to. So KDiff 3 by default, when you open it up, it kind of offers you many options, but one of them is the sort of the obvious one, I guess, is to define file A and file B, and then that'll open A, B up in a typical diff configuration with A on the left, B on the right. There's the differences. As far as I could tell, there's no way to merge those differences. It is purely a diff tool. So I got the very distinct feeling, and admittedly I was influenced by Josh's email, which says, you know, hey, just make this your output for Git merge, or your Git merge tool. So that kind of gets you the feeling of, well, this isn't one of those GUI apps that you're supposed to just launch. You know, it's like one of those that's going to be the end of your pipeline. So maybe I'm influenced by that, but it did kind of feel that way, you know, like, because just a typical or a raw KDiff 3 A and B shows you A and B, and that's all it just shows you. You cannot merge in that state. Now, if you want to merge, then you open up KDiff 3 and define A and B. By the way, you can actually define C as well, so you can do a three-way merge or whatever, or a three-way diff. But let's just go with A and B for now. So A and B, and then if you click the little merge checkbox, then it gives you the option for an output file. And then you can define an output file that does not yet exist, and that will be the file that contains whatever you've decided to merge. So this is different than either bcompare or compare, in that if you're diffing and you suddenly decide, oh my gosh, I should merge, then that's kind of, you have to stop and do something different. You know, you have to come up with some other, you have to do a different step. And maybe I'm being too harsh. I mean, there are some options in KDiff 3 that I didn't really go too deeply into, so maybe I'm missing, like, the area that you can sort of switch modes. But I didn't, certainly by default, I didn't see that right away. There is a merge menu, so that might have been what I was missing. But when you open up KDiff, you tell it, yes, I want to merge, and then you define an empty file for it to put everything into, and then you've got your kind of three, you know, your left and right panel on the top, and then a complete new, like, hey, this is the file you're merging to, on the bottom. And the merge conflicts are kind of, the merged file, the output file, is is everything that is similar, that, you know, everything that is the same from your A and B files with just this red message merge conflict where it can't decide which one to use. Now, it seems to be, not very obvious as to how to get, how to resolve a merge, frankly. I had a lot of, I had a lot of clicking around on the, toolbar, kind of rolling things over, trying to find the button, you know, because both compare and bcompare had everything kind of up in the toolbar with either arrows or, well, I think arrows really was the, was sort of the tip off for me. And this really doesn't exactly have that same kind of like, whoa, we're going from left to right or right to left. It doesn't use that as a model. It very much is saying, this is your A file, this is your B file, you pick what you want. And once you have that internalized, you're fine. You don't think about left or right anymore. And I think the left and right model for me at least was kind of, I kind of had that ingrained because even the diff tool on the command line sort of does that, you know, it kind of points to the left and points to the right, and you're like, well, which file did I list first again? Oh yeah, that one. So that's on the quote, quote left, and that one's on the right. So, it was kind of a shock for me to not think about left and right. But it actually works really well. So in this combined file, this new file that you're merging together, your first conflict is, my first conflict, let's say, is on line one here, and it says, okay, there's a merge conflict, and it doesn't even show me the text. So you look up at the top and you see what, where your A and B files are, and you can kind of see, okay, I've got some lines here on A, and I've got a big blank space over on B, so I'm going to take the lines from A. And the way that you can do that is there is indeed a button up at the top, select lines from A, select lines from B. And I missed those lines because in the diff mode, those buttons are empty. You cannot click those buttons. They're just A, B, and C, and they're not active. So I kind of assumed that they were non-functioning buttons and kind of forgot about them. But what you can also do is you can right-click on the merge conflict in your output pane and tell it select lines from A or from B. And then you notice, oh my gosh, there's a Control 1 or a Control 2 keyboard shortcut. So you just do a Control 1 and then it pastes in the merge conflict or the, you know, the merge resolution, the thing that you want to you want to insert. And then you can click on the go to the next merge conflict button up in the toolbar, or if you're doing this a lot, you can use keyboard shortcuts, go to the previous delta with control up, or go to the previous delta, sorry, is control page up, delta is control page down. Sorry, I said that wrong again. There's a concept of delta versus conflict, and I get that the delta is once the conflict has been resolved, and the conflict is a conflict. So yeah, it gets a little bit confusing. So the next conflicts are page up and page down. Control page up, control page down. Delta is control up and down, and that confuses me a little bit too. But whatever. I mean, it's better than nothing. I wasn't even using anything in either compare and or bcompare, and within 5 minutes of using KDIF3, I was like, just really kind of in love with the keyboard shortcuts. And I don't know why that is. I guess it really is the least GUI of the three, and it kind of pushes you towards learning the keyboard shortcuts because you don't have nice little buttons saying, hey, merge from the left, merge from the right. You just kind of, yeah, you're sort of dragging your mouse over buttons and trying to figure out what to click and right-clicking for context menus, hopefully. So yeah, it gets a little bit strange. So yeah, you can go to different conflicts and you control 1 or 2 for A and B or control 3 for C. And so basically you're just replacing these nebulous entries of, hey, I don't know what to do, merge conflict, with an entry from either A or B. So to me, this was a lot more clear than the B compare merge. And I guess in a way, I guess in a way it's almost more clear than the compare model, where you're kind of nervous. Yeah, you don't have, unless you go to the effort to make it yourself, you don't have that third output file. You've got this sense of, I am taking this destination file which exists and merging into it the conflict. So this one, yeah, I really did like this model. It just kind of clicked. Something really kind of clicked. And when I say it clicked, it's kind of crazy because this is the third one that I looked at. Not that I was like confused by compare and be compare. For some reason, it all made a lot more sense with KDIFF3. At the same time, I felt like it was a harder program to sort of dive into. It was a little bit frustrating, and possibly if I'd been doing this with SVN when I was like trying to figure out SVN merge conflicts and kind of panicking that my merge wouldn't go through, I might not have given this a whole lot of time to kind of step through it. I think of the three, this is definitely what I would consider a power user tool, and I very rarely look at something and say, oh, that's for power users, and actually mean it. And in this case, I kind of do, and I mean it in a really good way. And it's kind of the same way as like, maybe a flow blade for video editing. You kind of look at it, and you think, well, I know what I'm doing, so this is great. But I wouldn't necessarily push this on someone to introduce them to the idea of merging conflicts, because it's just kind of it's a little bit complex and not super obvious as to what you're supposed to click. You know, I kept right clicking in A and B. Like, I kept right clicking trying to say, yes, I want that change. No, that won't work. Okay. And then none of the buttons were highlighted. So it got very, very confusing and very a little bit frustrating, because I just couldn't figure out how I was supposed to tell it what to do. But after I figured it out, it's really, really good. And then remember how in bcompare I was saying that I was a little bit confused in the combined file in their merge tool as to which block I had actually pulled from. No such issue with KDIFF3. It's very, very clear as to which block of code you pulled from, because it says right along the side for each line, it gives you A and B and whatever. So if you are looking at your third file, your merged file, and you think, okay, well, I chose originally A, or let's say I chose BB for these two lines, but really I changed my mind. I think the lines in A are better. You just go down to that delta and then click A, and that swaps it out for, or that inserts the A ones, and then you can turn off the B lines. So it's, you're not swapping, I guess. You're adding and subtracting. So you can, and you can do that. Like, if you're on a delta, it tells you where it's at, and then you can bring in B. So now you've got both A and B lines, and then you can turn off the A lines or whatever, and now you're back to B. So yeah, you there's a lot of flexibility there. It's really pretty neat. It makes it very clear as to what's happening. The buttons in the toolbar, they get a little bit frustrating because they're, when you first look at them, again, I was looking for left and right, and it wasn't there. And then you're kind of looking at them, and you're thinking, oh, but I want to go down, and they're grayed out. Well, that's because you're trying to click on the conflict down when you really want the next delta down. So the differentiation between delta and conflict, it takes you a little bit of getting used to. But it's an important distinction, so you get used to it pretty quickly. And then just kind of contextually, when you're allowed to choose something from A or B is constrained. I mean, if you're in the A file, those you can't choose from A or B, because you're not merging into A, you're not merging into B. You have to be in your merged file in order to be able to click on A or B or C, because that's your active writable file. And then, of course, you save, and there's no destruction. There's, you haven't screwed up A or B. You've got this third new file that represents the merge. And frankly, it's just really nice. So, if I had to rank them magazine style, I think I would probably... I would probably honestly choose KDIF 3. I thought Compare was really cool. I really liked it. And I still do. And I'll probably still use it. But KDIF 3 is really nice. It makes merging very quick. It makes it very clear as to what you're pulling from. It's just, yeah, it's pretty slick. It's pretty nice. And it's just... It's simple, you know, it just has one of those feelings of, you know, those apps in Linux where it's a GUI app, but you look at it with one eye closed and you kind of focus on it and you think, I can see right through that GUI and I can see exactly the commands that it is invoking. And maybe not literally, you know, it's probably not literally invoking the commands that you're thinking of, but it may be literally invoking the same libraries as those commands do. Or it may be invoking those commands, but you can see it, you know? And it starts to make more sense because you can see what the computer does. And that's how KDIF 3 seems. Compare, similar, but not quite as explicit. And B-Compare is somewhere with Compare. I would rank B-Compare and Compare as basically being the same application for my purposes. And I think it's interesting, too, that it took me sort of three diff experiences, three different tools to kind of come to the realization that you could diff into a, or you could merge into a third file. I never really thought to do that. And that's probably because the way I was using it, SVN, I had a very distinct, like, I wanted this file to exist, and I wanted this file to contain the differences from this previous conflict. So I had this kind of idea of, well, I'm trying to bring in changes missing from this file. Whereas really when you're doing that, you are making a third file, whether you're writing over your second file or not, but you're making a third file. And it took me B-Compare, Compare, and KDIF 3 to realize that, yeah, that's actually what I'm doing. I'm actually just writing a new file, essentially. So that was interesting. Yeah, really cool tools, though. Very interesting. And each of them have a little bit of a different take on something that I kind of thought just there couldn't be that many takes on. So we should take a coffee break, because why not? And then I'm going to come back and talk a little bit about paid applications on Linux. Back. Hope you had a great cup of coffee. I know I did. I usually do, if I'm making my own coffee especially. So the idea of paid applications on Linux is becoming more and more relevant. I'm not saying that it has not been relevant. It's been relevant for quite some time, but it's had an unsteady foothold in general. Famously, of course, back when Linux was first sort of surfacing, there were companies that attempted to come out with purchasable software for Linux, and it kind of worked and it kind of didn't, and mostly it just didn't. And I don't know exactly why. I don't know the history of it, and I have a sort of a notion, and this may not be accurate, and people who have been using Linux for longer than me are certainly welcome to chime in on this. If you don't listen to my show all the time, for reference, I've been using Linux since about 2006-ish. I could look that up specifically. I could get a date for you, because this podcast sort of, this podcast was along for the ride when I switched to Linux, so I could find out the exact date, although there is some flirtation previous to switching wholesale. But the point is that, yeah, the paid software thing kind of worked, kind of didn't. And, you know, you've got id Software, the gaming company that published and sold Linux games for a while quite famously. And it was a kind of a major milestone, I reckon, for a homebrew operating system. And it continues to this day, not id Software, but there are still applications that are sold for Linux, certainly. Big ones, really important ones, like software that costs upwards of thousands of dollars. I mean, like the 3D software and the rendering software that's used in most visual effects studios today are all running on Linux workstations, and they're sold to studios in bulk. I mean, it's hundreds and hundreds of licenses are sold, and of course there are, and they run on the workstations. You know what I mean? Like, it's not, we're not talking about a hazy kind of, oh, this is a render farm software, and so you need licenses to be able to check out a GPU for your thing to render quicker. It's not like that. I'm talking about the actual Qt-based C++ code of software, you know, like Maya and Nuke and Hero and lots of other applications that are used in movies right now. And they're used by hundreds of people. I mean, like, hundreds of people sit down at a desk running Linux every day at movie studios in the U.S. and in New Zealand and in London and in Sydney and Perth, I think it's Perth, and run Linux to do this movie stuff, and it's sold, and it's a major moneymaker for certain software houses. So it happens all the time, and of course recently with Steam, with Valve pushing Steam for Linux, such as they are, I wouldn't say it was a huge push, unfortunately, but I mean, certainly they have something like 1,000 games or more than that for Linux that are being bought and sold every day by some percentage of users. So, again, it happens, it's around, it's occurring. But it's funny when you come across something, some little fiddly software thing like a comparison tool, and they think that it's worth releasing for Linux and selling licenses for that. And you kind of look at it and you just think, wow, that's kind of cool. I came to a software site and I actually have the option to purchase a version of the software for Linux. But then the free software enthusiast in you kind of kicks in, and you think, wait a minute, why am I flattered by this? I shouldn't be excited about this. I don't need to pay for my operating system to be validated. And I think there's a lot of value in that kind of reaction, actually. I think that if we're relying on this idea that we haven't made it until someone charges us for something, that's a really dangerous and kind of, I would say, a sort of a sad state for a project to be in. But it is very pervasive. I mean, it really is. It's one of those things where if you're designing a game, for instance, like a tabletop game, a card game or something, very frequently you're not really taken seriously until you've gotten it mass produced. Right? I mean, like, there are, if you go to drive-through RPG.com or drive-through-cards.rpg.com, there are games ready for print and play. You can print them out and start playing them in one afternoon, but they're not taken seriously by game reviewing podcasts or whatever, because they haven't been, you know, they're not boxed and cellophaned. And that's really, really sad to me. That's hugely, that's just kind of a travesty of modern society and modern culture, that in order for your work to be culturally significant, it has to have gone through China, essentially, in order for it to be real. Same thing for Smashwords and Lulu.com and places like that. You know, you've got these places where you can publish a book or a calendar or an agenda, a diary, whatever. You know, whatever you want to put on printed page, you can post it to these sites. You can have people pay or not pay. It can be printed on demand and sent to them, or you can be selling it as an ebook. And again, it's not authentic until it has been certainly stamped by the government with a ISBN number, and it hasn't been, and it should, that kind of gives it some authenticity. But if it hasn't passed through some publishing house, then it's not the real deal. So I could go on and on about examples of this thriving culture that just simply is not recognized by kind of the loudest portion of the media, because it hasn't been, you know, it hasn't gotten that stamp of inclusion, and therefore isn't allowed into the same club. That's a real pity, and I think that operating systems, I think we have to be careful not to fall prey to that same illusion that we can't be a real OS until people can go to a store and put money down on a counter for it. But the flip side of that coin is that if there are people out there who are making money by being developers and they want to continue to do that, these people may not be really invested at all in what you run their software on. They just want to know that if they take 8 hours of their day to figure out how to build the thing on your OS, that's going to pay off, like in a very literal sense. Like, I mean, hard numbers here. If you have 5 working days a week and you have 30 days in a month and you have rent that costs some amount of money, and food and utilities, then for each working day, you kind of divide out how much money you need to earn on each day for you to end up with an amount that's going to total your rent and money and your food and utilities. And so if you spend one of those days just adjusting your software for a certain platform, then you need to know that day is going to still have an income equal to all the other days. And that's just how it works for any freelance worker. That is how it works. Less so for the big companies, which I think their accounting gets so messy and so abstracted that it's kind of hard to really assign direct outcomes. But assuming that we're just talking about developers who are sitting at home writing stuff and selling it online, that's an important consideration. So if those people feel that they are able to get paid for their work, then I think that they would feel secure publishing for a certain platform. And I think that's kind of where the whole question of, do I want to pay for my Linux software, rises to the surface. And I think I've already talked a little bit about this in the past. Ardour, obviously, the audio software, famously charges some amount of money for their software. $1 minimum. I think $60 or $40 for a year or whatever it is, or until, you know, for updates up until the next major release. I think that works out pretty nicely, and it's open source. So it's really a donation, but it's a donation that is highly encouraged, and I think that works out really, really well. I think that's a great model, because you get your cake and you can eat it too. You can have your open source, especially in the creative world, where I think, you know, the reassembly of your project, of your work, depends on the thing that you are building it in. So you want to have the code of that of that tool set. You want to make sure that you can replicate your work today, tomorrow, 3 years from now. You want to make sure that that can happen. For diff tools, it's a little bit less important, I think. I mean, to be fair, a diff tool is I mean, there are lots of them. The output is not specific to that tool. It's something that can be replicated with lots of different things. It is independent. The output is independent of the tool that you used to build it. I guess what I'm saying is that there's an exit strategy, and that's a big deal within corporate software choices. Is there an exit, or it should be a big deal? Is there an exit strategy? If this tool, if this software tool goes the way of the dinosaur, can we replace it and have our data remain intact? That's a huge deal, and it should be. I mean, it typically is among serious corporations that I've ever encountered. But it is one of those things that's very easy to get lulled into a sense of security, and you kind of start to think, well, it's always going to be around. And then, of course, when it stops being around, people panic. And it doesn't happen that often, but it does happen. I mean, and it happens famously. One of my favorite stories of all times, and it's like one of those things that really affected my industry in a serious way, was the Final Cut Pro fallout. Final Cut Pro had been the same for years, for a decade. It had changed an industry, and then they just cut it off. They just said, we're not doing that anymore. We're going to do something different. Same name, completely different software. And it was a real problem. I mean, like, huge problem. You can't imagine how much of a problem. And that's just kind of, no one ever thought that would be a thing that would ever happen. No one saw that coming. It just happened out of the blue. So, in terms of open standards versus open source, that kind of question, certainly a diff tool is right up there with not really that important. Like, if all open source diff tools went away and we were stuck with proprietary diff tools, I don't think it would be that big of a deal, honestly. Like, that's not one of those huge problems. I mean, you just pick one. Pick a diff tool and use it, and it'll pretty much do the same job. And for that reason, I'm not recommending bcompare, but I'm not recommending bcompare. It's something that you could get away with using, and I don't see that you would really find it all that reprehensible. And if bcompare disappeared from the face of the planet, the software just went away, you would not really be affected. You might have to learn a different diff tool, but generally speaking, your work is still, your work has been unaffected. The merged files still exist. Everything's fine. There are no problems. So the interesting thing about paying for closed source software on an open software system, to me, at least in this context, is that I don't want to get too metaphysical here, so let's not. Well, I'll say what I was thinking, okay? So maybe there's like this balance to the universe, and this is super ridiculous, but let's say that there's a balance to the universe where you can have a closed system and you can use open software on it, but if you want to have an open system, then you must use closed software upon it. You know, like, so the scales must balance, right? The Skeksis and the Gelflings must both exist for each, you know, for there to be balance. So you've got sort of these two choices to make. And I'm saying this because of recent experiences in a couple of different industries that I've seen where, you know, you're kind of looking at a problem and you're saying, well, this could be solved with open source. Like, we could just do it with open source. And yes, people would have to adjust their workflow and learn new software, but it could be done. And the expenses would go to sort of supporting the open source software rather than paying for the closed source software. It's a trade-off. So if you're thinking about it in a less fantastical sort of terminology, then you might just kind of think about it as a sense of where's the false security in a system. And that is to say, when you're going to your person, your purchaser, and you're saying, okay, I want to invest in a little bit of this and a little bit of that, they're going to look at the risks of those things that you're giving them. And if one of those things is a super closed off proprietary system that that in your mind is reprehensible because you would never want to get anywhere near it, and in their mind it's super secure. I mean, it's like a safe bet, I should say. Not secure, like security, like system security, like information security. I'm just saying, like in terms of, if I pay my money, am I not going to have to worry about this anymore? That proprietary system for them is it. They're like, that's perfect. Everything is taken care of. I'm buying a whole package. I'm getting people, you know, if there are any problems, I can just call them up. And I can say, hey, set this up for me. I mean, GitLab.com just had a major outage again this past weekend, because their proprietary backend of Azure had some kind of storage problem. Guess what they did? They threw Azure under the bus. Like, they posted, hey, we're having trouble, but it's not our fault. It's Azure's problem, and they've got this power outage in their storage, something ridiculous like that. And you're just thinking, why would you even do that? And the reason is because that way, when something fails, you can point the finger at someone else and say, well, we paid for the package and they went down, so don't blame us this time. This time it wasn't us deleting a directory that we weren't supposed to delete, which they did about a month ago, or 2 months ago, or 6 months ago. I don't know, some time ago. So you've got your two packages that you're handing your purchasing agent, and you're saying, okay, you can get this closed thing, and that's your safe bet, and then add on to that the open stuff that I like, because that's the one that makes sense for what we're doing. It's the technological, the technology analysis has opted for this system because of blah blah, the API or whatever, the extensibility, whatever, the licensing options, whatever. And that's kind of that's kind of the right mix for a purchasing agent. And that's why I'm saying, like, I think that if you're going to these people and you're saying, you can have one, we need these options, these solutions purchased, I kind of get the sense that there needs to be a mix there. Because if you go to them with a completely open solution, I feel like there's not enough there for them to fall back on. I feel like, for a lot of people in industries, and obviously I'm technically speaking about maybe the one or two industries that I know, which is film and IT, but I'm imagining this to be true for lots of other things, then they look at if they look at your packages and it's all open, then they don't see anywhere that they can kind of, they don't see the bottom. They don't see the foundation. All they see is like these things that you kind of poked around and found on the internet. Whereas if you give them something open and then something closed, then they can sort that out on the table in front of them. You know, they can kind of push these blocks that are one color over in this corner and these blocks in that corner, and they can kind of see, okay, yeah, that balances out. So these systems, those will never fail because we paid for them. And these ones, the weird ones, they're a little bit nebulous, and we're not sure who we're paying or what we're paying for. But that's our risk, and that's acceptable. But if everything's off in one corner, at least on the open side, then that's not good. And if everything's over on the closed side, then someone might come along and say, well, that's not good either, because we have no exit strategy for this, this, and this. And that would be really bad. Like, our database needs to be open because we want to make sure that we have control over that. And our web framework needs to be open because that's where all the development's happening. And this needs to be happening because this is just industry standard, and it would be stupid to pay Microsoft for that because nobody uses that. So that's what we'll do. You know, so you've got like this mix of closed and open. I'm not saying I like it. I'm just saying that in this weird kind of odd way, I almost feel like, at least for the industries as they exist right now, there needs to be that balanced mix of quote-unquote sound investments versus, you know, whatever, like the open stuff that's just whatever, you know, they still don't understand it, which is amazing because you do have companies like Red Hat, and you have companies like OpenSUSE, or SUSE rather, and you have companies like, well, even Canonical, you have lots of companies that are huge, you know, and they're major players, but people still don't quite understand the whole open source thing and how that could possibly be a sound investment. So I'm thinking that in a weird, and you can choose your fantasy, you know, there must be balance in the universe option, or you can choose the Klaatu is pretending like he understands economics method, but whichever those two resound for you, or resonate for you rather, I feel like there might need to be a mix for the current sort of state of business transactions. I feel like people need to know that either their platform is a sound investment and the apps that they're running are wild and crazy, or vice versa. And I've seen this in lots of different industries. I really have. I've seen a lot of places of different kinds, both IT and film, that will be running a completely open OS, but a whole host of closed applications. And frankly, they almost start to gravitate towards the closed applications for some weird reason. Like, for everything, you know? It's like, even for, like, an email client, they'll be like, oh, we can't use this one. Thunderbird just doesn't cut it for us. For some weird reason, you know? They're like, oh, we have to pay for Google Apps, or we have to pay for Microsoft One Ring to Rule Them All, whatever it's called. OneDrive, you know, or 365, whatever it's called. So, you know, and it's weird. So you get like this super great open platform, but then pile on a whole bunch of closed stuff. Or vice versa, you get this super closed platform, but people keep throwing on open stuff because they're like, oh, we want to pay for an email client. Nobody pays for email clients anymore, or whatever, you know? So yeah, that's kind of a theory that I wouldn't say that I'm working on that theory, but it's a theory that I had as I was kind of poking around with BCompare. And I just thought, why would anyone pay $60 or whatever it is for BCompare when you've got Compare and KDiff3? And I think one of the reasons is that it feels good to pay for stuff on an open system. For whatever purpose, whether it's just because you think that paying for it makes it seem more official, or because you think that it's a better investment for your infrastructure to pay for it, or whatever the reason is, or you just like BCompare better than Compare or KDiff3. It exists, and I think in a way it needs to exist. It needs to exist for the users, and it needs to exist for the developers. So I'm not saying you need to go buy BCompare, or that you need to pay for a license for Lightworks, or that you need to pay for, well, you should. You should pay for Ardour. What's the other one? There's another DAW out there. Renoise, and then Bit something. There are a couple of different audio workstations out there that you can pay for. I'm not saying you need to go out and buy closed applications for your open system. I'm just saying that it might be good that they exist. For one reason or another, it might be a good sign that it exists, and it might be persuasive that they exist. So don't ignore them. I'm not saying switch over to them or anything, but I am saying, like, that choice, the choice to pay, is sometimes a good thing in a weird way. Okay, I think that's it for this episode. Thank you very much for listening, as always. My name is Klaatu. You can find me online at GNUWorldOrder.info or at SlackerMedia.info. You can find me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation, .org. And you can also find me on linuxquestions.org as notklaatu. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time.